this quote-unquote universal car that I mentioned, the other part of our lab is really geared at trying to make these products, all of these CAR T-cell products, safer. You know, we talked a lot about the side effects that these kids and adults get them too. You know, we talked a lot about what they go through, needing intensive care units. It's really expensive, you know, and hard on the patient. So we need to come up with a better way, a better product that we can give these patients. So we're approaching that in really two ways. One is a way that we can control the on and off state, and we can flip a switch, if you will, and turn it on, flip it back, and then it turns off, and vice versa. And then the other way is a mechanism that we've designed that will automatically sense a lot of the inflammation that's going on in patients, and that turns it into an inhibitory signal or an attenuation of the signal that's given to the CAR T cell. So we kind of are almost creating a rheostat, if you will, to balance the tumor killing with the side effects.
Dr. Daniel Traley, thank you for sharing your insights, and with good reason.
No, thank you so much, Sarah, for appreciate your time and your interest.
Dr. Daniel Traley is a pediatric oncologist at the University of Virginia and director of UVA's Pediatric Stem Cell Transplantation and Immunotherapy. This is With Good Reason. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is With Good Reason. You got to trust your gut unless your microbiome is suffering from too much of the wrong foods. Our guts are complex living things, a whole ecosystem within ourselves that we alone cultivate. And when we teach our guts bad habits, they stick. Dr. Jasmohan Bajaj is a professor of medicine at Virginia Commonwealth University and co-editor-in-chief of the American Journal of Gastroenterology. He says gut health plays a huge role in addiction. Jasmohan, in your own research, you transplanted bacteria from one person's stool into 10 volunteers who had severe alcohol use disorder and cirrhosis of the liver. Apparently, 9 of them experienced reduced cravings and drank less, compared to only 3 in the placebo group. What is the status of that experiment now?
We followed them up for several months afterwards, and we found that this craving reduction, which was at day 15, translated into improvement in alcohol-related hospitalizations afterwards. So not only did this last for 15 days, it lasted for more than 6 months afterwards. Around 80% of the placebo group, unfortunately, were either hospitalized or seen in the emergency room for an alcohol-related condition over the next 6 months, whereas only 2 of the other group ended up being in the hospital or in the ER for alcohol-related problems.
Why did you suspect, before you even did the experiment, that this might be the case? What had been done before you?
We have been studying what we call the gut-brain axis for quite a long time. And we, as a transplant liver specialist, I'm also one of the authorities in a disease called hepatic encephalopathy, where the brain does not function because your liver is a problem. So people with cirrhosis, like the ones we included in this trial, often get a situation where they become comatose or very confused because of products that are made by the gut. And the treatment for that is not really a treatment for the brain. It's not really a treatment for the liver. All we do is make the people's microbes behave better by having them have multiple bowel movements. So if a patient can come to you comatose, if they have this condition, you have to give them things that make them have several bowel movements, and they will wake up. So this actually prompted us to look further as to whether other things that are concomitant in these patients, including alcohol use disorder and other substance use disorders that lead to cirrhosis, could also have an impact related to this. It builds upon decades and years of research that us and other people have done in the field of how the liver, the gut, communicate with the brain, and how this can be actually manipulated to help patients.
When the consequences of your experiment were made more widely known, did you find that people misinterpreted how revolutionary this might be?
I think hope springs eternal in everyone's chest, and that's what happened. I got so many emails from people who wanted to explore this option because either them or their loved one had tried everything else, and my heart really goes out to them because I see this in my clinic, and it is from that area of trying to heal patients that we came up with this trial.
And again, was this what we call a fecal transplant?
It would be called a fecal transplant, but it's kind of a misnomer. Even though the microbes that we transplant come from someone's feces, they are actually quite processed. They're actually in a form where it's in a capsule. The capsules are completely smell-free, and they are easily swallowable. They do not dissolve anywhere. So any of the misgivings that potential people might have are easily fixed when you actually tell them what it's actually all about.
But we're still a long way from being able to go down to the CVS pharmacy and ask for these capsules, right?
Yes. Like any drug, you want to first make sure that you do a phase one study, which means it's safe, which we have done. A phase two study, which means it is effective in a larger group of population, which is we are in the process of doing. And then a phase three trial, which means larger and larger groups of people get assigned to it to make sure this is then safe for this situation. Right now, we are in the phase two phase for this exploration. You do not want to jump a drug prematurely or any medication prematurely before a careful analysis of the risks and benefits are understood. So therefore, it may be a good thing that you don't get it in CVS right now because it is not ready for prime time.
What do you think it is in our gut when we're addicted to, let's say, alcohol that leads to this mental craving?
It's a two-way street. And I truly say that the way to your brain is through your gut. And this is important for us to realize because alcohol use disorder is a very complicated disorder. It has psychosocial aspects, which means what was your environment like? It has genetic aspects. What were your parents like? What are your siblings like? And it has a strong biological signature as well, in addition to genes, which is the gut microbes. So the gut microbes can process the alcohol and then produce some products that are harmful to your gut as well as your liver, which unfortunately cause a positive cycle for craving and getting more alcohol on board. So this is one of the many parts that is abnormal or something that needs to be fixed. And the hope is that anyone who comes in with alcohol use disorder, that microbiota in the future may be one of the many things that we can offer to these patients either solely or together with existing and future therapies that those patients might need.
It's so interesting that you have said our microbiome or gut is like a second brain for us. Could you expand on that?
Yes, the microbiome produces a lot of neurotransmitters, which are chemicals that help transmit nerve signals. They also generate hormones, and they generate all the chemicals that you would need for the nerves to actually function. And more importantly, our gut has more nerves than the spinal cord. So therefore, when you say you have a gut feeling, it is actually true. There is actually gut feelings. This can be transmitted directly to the brain or through the bloodstream. So they have the capability of affecting a lot of processes. They affect how we actually digest food, and we already talked about how they affect how we digest and process alcohol. They also have the capability of changing the medications, whether the medications are more active or less active. So all these things make it a very interesting but very complicated scenario.
Was there a moment in your own professional career that this really sank in for you and you changed what you put into your gut?
Yes, I've always been a relatively moderate coffee drinker, but I've actually become a bigger coffee drinker. Clearly, after this, I am a teetotaler. I do not like the taste of alcohol. So I don't know. That was never an issue had here. But what we do have is I have been very mindful about eating. And by mindful, I meant is to make sure I actually do not scarf down the food, do not gulp it down, actually understand what I'm eating and make sure that everything that goes into my mouth, actually I know what potential consequences might be for my gut.
What else are you seeing in the labs of others around the world and around the country that have excited your interest?
So my interest is always on high level when it comes to gut microbes. But clearly, there have been some other provocative studies, albeit in mice right now, that aging can be reduced. When you take gut microbes from young mice and put them into older mice, the older mice actually start behaving like younger mice. And other studies, including our own, have shown, have actually differentiated between people who have post-traumatic stress disorder, which, as you know, is a big consequence of war and deployment-related issues, in their microbes. So we are getting inspiration daily from multiple reports that are coming out, not only in the humans, but in animals. And also, we are always relentlessly pursuing the precision matching that I talked to you about. Which patient, which donor, which recipient, which condition.
Is that the area that is showing the most promise? We've talked about that, let's say, in chemotherapies, the administering of certain therapies for certain cancers and certain patients. This also is the case for gut medications.
Absolutely. That is such a fascinating way, as the gut microbes can actually process medications for us. And in fact, sometimes we need them to process medications or activate certain medications into their form in which they can fight cancers. In revolutionary studies done in the past, smaller still all of now, when you gave a fecal transplant to a patient who was unresponsive to chemotherapy, they suddenly became responsive to chemotherapy because the correct gut microbes, which were missing previously, were now introduced that changed those drugs to their active form that now were able to fight cancer. So we are just scratching the surface of this immense resource that we have in us and outside us. And we want to actually make sure that we don't oversell the promise, but we also keep people abreast of what's going on without falsely raising hopes.
This has been so exciting talking with you. Thank you for sharing your insights on With Good Reason.
And thank you so much for your invitation.
Dr. Jesmohan Bajaj is a liver specialist and professor of medicine at Virginia Commonwealth University. He's also chair of the North American Consortium for Study of End-Stage Liver Disease. My next guest is also researching our internal plumbing, but at an even more granular level. When she was a chemical engineering student at Tulane in Louisiana, Jennifer Munson studied the way oil moves through pipes at big oil refineries. She saw a connection between those pipe systems and the different joints and pipe systems in her body. Her career letter to Genentech in San Francisco, and then a Fulbright scholarship in Switzerland. Munson is now a professor at Virginia Tech's Fralin Biomedical Research Institute. She's working with other researchers there to approach illnesses with greater attention to the way fluid moves through our bodies and affects our health. Her belief is that fluid flow and drainage through a tumor can alter how a tumor responds to drugs, and understanding that may lead to new tumor treatments. Jenny, tell me about when you first started thinking about body fluid flow. I understand you were a chemical engineering student at Tulane University in Louisiana, and you were traveling around the state and saw the way that oil moves through pipes in these big factories all around you.
Yeah, so during my undergraduate career, a big part of our work and our study was to visit chemical plants, oil plants in Louisiana, especially southern Louisiana. It's just filled with them. So we'd drive for, you know, sometimes hours out through the swamps, and we'd get to these huge plants just rising out of like the flatness that is Louisiana. And so you'd see these giant towers. Yeah. And you just knew that there were just this massive amounts of fluids, gases and liquids moving through these things. And we were there to model them and see them and understand them and try to describe them mathematically was our real purpose. And so when I was looking at these things that are so massive, when you really think about it, the same types of movements and the same types of fluid transport is happening in our body all the time. And so that's kind of where I started really thinking about, you know, fluid flow and where I really fell in love with it, I guess, because it was just this really neat phenomenon, and it's just happening all the time. And the same there, it's happening all the time. And, you know, at an oil plant, it's so important because it can be very dangerous if something goes awry. But the same is true in your body. Like, it can be dangerous if something goes wrong with your fluid flow.
How big a deal is fluid flow in our body? It's mostly what, water or blood that we're thinking of?
So it's all water. I mean, our bodies are comprised of almost all water in general. We, I think, you know, generally think of blood. That's what we think of when we think of liquids in our body, because you get a cut on your finger and blood comes out. And that's what you see. But there's also things like lymph, which is just the stuff that's moving into your lymphatic system, which is draining your body. You have, and then you have the fluid in between the blood and the lymph, which is this interstitial fluid, which is one of our foci in my group.
So how does water flow through our bodies? You're right. It's probably a lot more than I realize. It flows in and around tissues.
Yes. So I think many people are familiar with the circulatory system, which is moving blood throughout our body. And that blood is essential, you know, for every tissue in our body to stay alive. But what happens after the blood gets to a tissue? You don't think about what happens next. And I think that that's, you know, just as important, because if you just had the blood being made and moving through our bodies and it never, that fluid never went anywhere, you can have problems. And we do see that clinically.
Now, as a biomedical researcher, you're looking at how the flow of water around brain cells can aggravate cancer and even Alzheimer's disease. What's the relationship between water flowing in and around cells and cancer or Alzheimer's?
Yeah, so you need that water to move around the cells, because its number one function, as far as we know, is to deliver nutrients and remove waste. And so you need that to happen. But what it's also doing, and what we're really interested in, is how that movement of the fluid is actually telling cells to do different things. And so the cells can actually feel that fluid moving along it, and they have a lot of different ways that they do that. And that can direct them to do different things. So in the case of tumor cells, we see that it can direct them to start moving, which is a first step towards creating secondary tumors or metastasizing. And so that's really a negative outcome that we want to avoid.
What leads to heightened fluid flow, which you said could facilitate tumor cell growth and metastases? What would happen in our bodies that might lead to heightened fluid flow?
Yeah, so when a tumor develops, it is, you know, this mass of cells growing in this confined space. And what happens is you're kind of, you know, filling that space, and it's causing pressure to build up. Additionally, These tumors have a lot of fluid coming into them. Because there's more cells there, they require more food, more nutrients, and so you get just more fluid buildup. And that has to go somewhere. So it's basically just that you have this pressure buildup, and it needs some sort of release valve. And so that release valve tends to be that the fluid just starts to go into the surrounding space wherever it can. And that is why you get these increases in the fluid flow compared to what is normally there, which is much lower.
How can you see the flow? How can you tell flow is increased around a tumor?
Yeah, so we use some imaging methods that are used in the clinic. So if a patient comes in with a tumor, they undergo MRI imaging. And so we can use standard imaging methods to actually mathematically determine what the flow is like in those tumors.
I understand there aren't many researchers who are this laser focused on looking at fluid flow when it comes to treating disease?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think there's just a handful of us really examining it. And in the brain, we're, I believe, the only group looking at it in this context, really trying to understand how fluid is moving in these small spaces between the cells.
Are we testing new drugs using fluid flow, or are we just testing them with cells in a petri dish?
I would say the majority of studies are looking at cells in a petri dish, which can be informative. And so one thing that I advocate for, and we always do, is test drugs with flow there, so that people can look at cells when they're feeling flow, as opposed to just kind of this static situation.
Has your lab come up with a good model for experimenting with cell and fluid flow?
Yeah, so we have a pretty basic model that we use. It requires a 3D space. So that's the tricky part, is that the nice thing about cells in a dish is you just plate them down and they sit there, and you don't have to do too many extra steps. With these, you actually have to look at fluid flow. You actually have to have a three-dimensional matrix in which these cells can live. And so that's what we work with. But I mean, there's plenty of these systems out there that can be used now. So I do think it's something that, you know, can be easily implemented. And my group is just working to, you know, make it even easier. So what is the simplest system that we could get off the shelf and be able to use to look at these cells in this context?
What is your fondest desire when you imagine a possible outcome of this research you and your team are doing?
I mean, ultimately, as a biomedical engineer, we want to help patients. And so I think the part of our work right now that I'm most excited about is our work to see fluid flow in patients, and then be able to help those patients clinically based on that information. And I think we're going at that in a bunch of different ways. And so that's really what I hope to see, is that we're able to take this, you know, method that we've developed and these systems that we've developed and actually see it, you know, cure a patient would be really amazing.
With Alzheimer's, you said it's more sort of the reverse. Is there also a problem when our blood flow becomes erratic or blocked or slows down?
Yeah, so I did research for a long time on the first case where flow is too fast. And so we were surprised when we did a few experiments and saw that in some cells, too fast was causing a bad response, but too slow was also causing the same bad response. And it needed to hit a sweet spot. And that it's probably, you know, patient and person specific.
Are there things we can do to improve the way fluids move in us?
Yeah, so it's probably a broken record, but, you know, a lot of the same things that help with, you know, all sorts of disease apply here. There's been really nice research that has shown that exercising can increase fluid flow in your brain, that getting a good night's sleep really helps. And that's really interesting, because actually they see that during when you're sleeping, your cells actually will shrink. And so instead of, you know, having a higher pressure to move fluid through or just having more fluid, you're actually just increasing the spaces between the cells. And so the fluid can get through more easily. So getting massages is always going to help kind of fluid drain out of your tissues, as well as, you know, just makes you feel better generally.
Yeah. On the sleep front, I saw a poster recently for power lifters that said, sleep, it's the greatest legal performance-enhancing drug.
Yes, it's definitely true. And I think about this all the time right now with a five-month-old at home.
Yeah. You are not getting a performing-enhancing drug, right?
Because I know, yeah. Lacking? And I think I could feel the cognitive performance.
Well, how nice that you got away for a night at least, right?
Yes.
Jennifer Munson is a bioengineer and cancer researcher at Virginia Tech's Fralin Biomedical Research Institute. Good Reason is produced by Virginia Humanities, which acknowledges the Monacan Nation, the original people of the land and waters of our home in Charlottesville, Virginia. Our production team is Allison Quantz, Matt Darrow, Lauren Francis, and Jamal Milner. Maya Neer and Cassandra Deering are our interns. For the podcast, go to withgoodreasonradio.org. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.
It's the KBOO Fall Drive, and our theme is The Sounds of Democracy. Everything you hear on KBOO is, in its own way, the sound of democracy, because we are a community radio station. Community radio is one of the most democratic types of media. We're non-commercial and independent. We're supported by our members so that we can keep the airwaves democratic and continue to bring you the valuable voices of your community. Democracy is an experiment, and so is community radio. We're featuring content focused on democracy itself and democratic ideas across the schedule this drive. And you can support KBOO by donating right now. Go to kboo.fm/give. Text KBOO to 44321 or click donate in the KBOO mobile app.
KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM and KBOO.FM online.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.